To support our work at the Izzy and Mortada Picture Show and the work of other independent creators like us, sign up to listen to the podcast on Nebula. Nebula is the creator-owned streaming platform that hosts great videos and podcasts like the one you're listening to now. Sign up today at nebula.tv/picture show, and you will get access to this podcast plus other great podcasts and videos. Sign up at Nebula and help support independent media creators. That's nebula.tv/picture show. Hi, I'm Mortada.
And I'm Izzy.
And this is the Izzy and Mortada Picture Show. We are back. We took a week off for Thanksgiving. Hope everybody had a good vacation. And now we are in December. We will have a busy December, although we're not working. At least I'm not working after the 15th. Izzy, I think you're taking time off too, right?
Yes. Well, I will be in London. So if anyone wants to say hi in London.
When are you going to be in London? When, starting when?
The 7th through the 12th.
Okay. All right. So, which means we will try to record like a few episodes to tide you through December.
Yes.
Because we've seen many of the movies that are going to be opening this month. But anyway, today, we're recording this on November 28th, but on December 1st, a Friday, opening in New York and LA is Poor Things, the movie that won the Golden Lion at Venice, the third of four collaborations between Yorgos Lanthimos and Emma Stone, and one of the most anticipated movies of the award season. Right, Izzy?
That's correct.
That's correct. I saw this movie at the New York Film Festival, and I loved it. And mm-hmm. I have always been an Emma Stone fan. I thought that people don't give her credit for what an inventive and just amazing actor she is, for her range, for her comedic chops, for her screen presence, and they just take her for granted as a pretty young white woman, but I think she's much more than that. I think she's in the mold of a Shirley MacLaine or a Madeleine Kahn, someone who is a wonderful actor.
Madeleine Kahn is a stretch.
Well, you know, it's my opinion. You know, what I want to say is that she's somebody who can land a laugh and
yes.
also be dramatic while having this amazing screen presence that just announces her as a star. And I think all of these things are apparent in this performance in Poor Things. I would venture to say, in my opinion, that it's probably her best performance, and not because she is doing something that she hasn't done before, but it's just that she's doing a lot of things in this film. The role itself just asks too much of her. She's on screen almost the entire time, and there's so much asked of her as she starts. You know, the movie is about this woman who commits suicide, and then the scientist played by Willem Dafoe puts the brain of her unborn child into her body. So she has a body of a 30-something woman, but she's actually a child. And so that's the premise. And so she has to act all of these things as this woman grows up. I love this movie, but I think you maybe have another opinion.
Well, I liked it. I didn't dislike it. I'm a very big Yorgos Lanthimos fan. So to me, like, I doubt that I'm ever going to, so far, I have not seen one of his that I was like, oh, I hate this. But
yeah.
I think I was on the B plus train.
Oh, B plus is very good.
Yeah. I think some of it I just found a little obnoxious. I think, like, to a certain extent, his films are always a little obnoxious.
Yes.
Like, the way that he writes his dialogue, I usually really like, but I found it kind of irritating in this. It felt, I mean, obviously a lot of people have been making comparisons to Barbie because they're kind of similar. It's like girl raised in this very specific world, breaking out and kind of discovering what life is all about in the real world, et cetera, et cetera. And some of the things that I found annoying about Barbie, I think were kind of also at play here, where it's like, you can't just say what a thing is because she doesn't know what it is. So it's like, oh, sex is like jumping vigorously. And it's just like, oh my God, like, that's not funny. Like, I just don't think that's funny. And there were so many examples of things like that throughout the film that I just kind of eye rolled at.
Yeah.
Similarly, like, I also think that she did a really good job, particularly in the back half, mostly back third. But the first third, where it was just kind of her, you know,
walking like a baby.
Frankenstein era. Yeah. I was just kind of like, okay, it felt a little like not about her performance, but like that role is very acting school to me, where it's like, the challenge today is pretend like you don't know how to walk. And it's just like, oh, like, I'm not interested in it.
Well, I felt the opposite. I think she's very strong in the third too, but I enjoyed the first part because I think, you know, the walking like a baby, the sort of throwing things, the awkwardness in all her movements, I think it allowed her, it gave her the chance to use her physical comedy, which she's very good at. And I found all those things funny, but also here, because she's playing, for lack of a better word, a baby, it just felt had a little more heft to it than just, she's not doing it just for laughs. She's doing it because that's how this person would act. And I thought of her interaction, especially with Rami Youssef, who is wonderful in this film. And he plays sort of the apprentice to Willem Dafoe's scientist, the person who is monitoring her as she's growing up, quote unquote. And just the interplay between them, I thought was really wonderful. And they found this together, they found this chemistry of like, of liking each other and not really like love. It's not like a sexual chemistry, but it's a chemistry of how you become comfortable with someone who's, because they're always there, they're always with you, and how you get to know them. And they had that familiarity. So, you know, we're not going to spoil, but by the end, their relationship sort of transforms and becomes something else. And when we get to that in the third part, which we're talking about, and she's matured and she's now, you know, a sophisticated person who learns about the world and all of that, it felt very believable that this would be the arc of that relationship. And I think that sort of relationship and those two actors, she and Rami, were so great together, and it sort of bounces off her other very physical relationship with Mark Ruffalo, which is more of a sexual thing.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with that. I think one of the problems, or I guess not the problem, but something that I kept finding myself thinking about when I was watching it, I was sort of like, am I missing a more complicated point that it's trying to make? Or is it really making a point that's kind of as simple as I think it is? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. What is the point you thought it was making?
Well, to me, I was like, it's just sort of illustrating the idea of growing up is like kind of learning to like be cynical about the world, but then also pulling yourself back from that and like making a space that is personal and like not just about how much the world sucks. And then there's like, you know, the parallel of like going through puberty and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then I was also like, okay. And you know what I mean? I was just sort of like, I don't know, like nothing about it. There wasn't a moment where I was like, oh, I feel extremely emotionally invested in this, in the sense that, in the way that I have in like other films that have come out this year, where you just like feel it physically in your gut and you're just like, oh my God, like that's something I've never thought about before. Like I've never seen this depicted like this before. And so like, I think there's a lot of really interesting things about it. And I think everybody's doing a really great job, but it just felt like it kind of fell flat because the ideas to bolster all of the really cool stuff that was happening like weren't necessarily there.
I mean, I don't entirely disagree with you. I think it's not as basic as Barbie, because Barbie is
I don't think it is either.
Barbie's about what it means to be a woman and just like, you know, feminism 101. And this, a lot of people have taken this, reading reviews and seeing what people are talking about, have taken it as that it's also about what it means to be a woman. But I think it just what it means about, you know, being born into this world. The world is terrible and we're all born into it, and we somehow need to find ourselves and need to find people we like and need to find hope and need to not kill ourselves when we just imagine what's happening in the world right now in Sudan, in Gaza, and all those things that are happening like every day. How do we even go on? And that's part of the film. Like, she discovers the brutality of the world and sort of like the failure of the human condition, basically. And yet she still, you know, charges through and finds a way, and not always the best way. You know, it's an up and down relationship. So I related to it from that perspective. Like, this is about how brutal and violent and awful it is to be born a human and expect to survive for, like, you know, an average of 70 years or 80 years or however long it is in this world as a human being. And with that perspective, I felt like it gave me something that you don't really get a lot. Plus, all the other things, like, it's a visual feast. Like, the costumes, the cinematography, the acting. Everybody's at 17 out of 10. Emma Stone is just moving up and down, working every last inch of her body, naked most of the time, which we shouldn't mention a lot, but it is there, and she's using her body to tell the story. Mark Ruffalo is giving these very funny comedic performance that is so extra, with the facial expressions, with the body expressions, but also believable as somebody sexy, and you will just forget how stupid they are and still want to fuck them. It's a great performance.
He was my favorite in the film, definitely. And also, I will say, like, I think that Yorgos Lanthimos has a way of directing his actors that feels like it can accidentally sometimes verge on what Wes Anderson does with his actors, which is, like, there's a very deadpan quality to his direction and his screenplays. And I was glad that nobody fell in that trap in this movie.
They got his tone. They were all working it. Like, you know, Hannah Shigula appears in a couple of scenes.
I know. I was like, why is nobody talking about this? That's what I was thinking about the whole time.
I was just like, hello.
She just showed up.
Hello, Fassbender Muse. Let's go. Gerard Carmichael playing the most cynical man ever on earth, and, you know, doing it so deadpan. We already talked about Rami and Mark Ruffalo. William Dafoe, you know, literally playing a monster with a heart. Like, he is the Frankenstein, the somebody who's, like, you know, their physical exterior is hard to look at and sort of bellies maybe somebody who is cruel, but he is the gentlest person in this film. And he's able to, you know, to do that despite, you know, all the prosthetics that he's under. And I just thought the acting in this is top notch. Top to bottom, every role is perfectly cast, and every person, I mean, even what's her name, who is in one scene or two scenes as the other Frankenstein lady, Maggie, Andy McDowell's daughter.
Oh, Margaret Qualley.
Margaret Qualley. She is even good in, like, two scenes playing, like, what if the experiment
she
went
really
wrong.
She really was there, yeah.
So, and what's his name, that actor people love, Christopher Abbott, playing the meanest man on earth. And he's
like
so good
lot.
At being mean. He's so good.
I really like him. He's really good. He's one of those who I think kind of goes under the radar, but is, like, good every time he's in anything.
He's great every time. I've seen him on stage too. He's great even on stage. And so there is extreme. Like I just said, you know, Gerard Carmichael is the most cynical man on earth. This Christopher Abbott is the meanest man on earth. So there are these extremes in character, in performance, that I can see being jarring. But somehow Yorgos Lanthimos, with his tone, with his dialogue that's always heightened and never, you know, and sort of never really how people speak, somehow all of that just gels together. Because and you know, I love frames that are full, and this movie has so many things to look at. Just the colors that pop, the costumes that pop, the places they go to, Lisbon and Alexandria, and it all looks like it was shot inside a big studio, like
blue room.
Like, I don't think they went to Lisbon, but so it doesn't feel real. But also, it's a story about a Lady Frankenstein, so nothing is real. Yeah. So all of this artifice sort of fits into the story, and it just makes it an enjoyable film to watch.
Yeah, I did. I really love the costumes, particularly that I think it's like a yellow tulle dress, or maybe that Emma Stone wears, something like that.
But, yeah.
I think when she's in Paris, I'm interested to see how this will do when it's actually released. I think obviously it's had a really strong critical reception. Most of the people I know who've seen it are very much in a, like a five stars for Poor Things camp.
Yes.
But I am curious how like a lot of older people will respond to it, because it is unafraid of showing a lot of things that I think, I don't know if more conservative viewers will just be like, what the hell am I watching?
I mean, I've already seen some people who don't love it and, you know, don't like the furious jumping, which is what she calls sex. And all the, you know, it's excessive. There's a lot of excess in this movie. And you're right, that will not be to everybody's liking or taste. But it is also, to me, I don't think it's as emotional, even though it is, to my mind, about the brutality of being human. It is not as emotional as some other movies that we've that have come out this year. It's a little bit more.
I don't know if it's for the melodrama girls, which is me. No. So I'm just like, maybe that's what it is.
Yes, but you know, that's Yorgos Lanthimos. He's like, that's not his thing. He's like, he goes to excesses, but not in emotion.
He wants things to be a little fucked up, which I really like.
Yes, yeah, and this is definitely fucked up. But I think I think it's gonna get I think people are gonna love it. Critics for sure love it, so it should factor into awards. I think it's looking at all those big awards: picture, director, actress, supporting actor, maybe twice, Willem Dafoe and Mark Ruffalo. I think if Lily Gladstone didn't have this amazing narrative this year, you know, we're recording this the day after the Gossams, where she won Best Actress for a movie that nobody has heard of. And it just...
Yeah, for just, quote unquote, No Country or whatever.
Yeah, The Country or something, which is not even Fancy Dance, which is an amazing film that she was in this year too. But it just means there is this goodwill towards her, and she is great in Killers of the Flower Moon. But my thing about that movie is that if it wasn't Lily Gladstone with the goodwill from the industry, with that narrative of no Native actor has ever won an Oscar, and that she has definitely paid her dues in the last decade or whatever, like, that's not a Best Actress winning performance or role. Not the performance. Let's just call it. It's not a
Lily
Best Actress.
Lily Gladstone's?
Yeah, it's not a Best Actress winning role, because it's sort of like the supportive wife, kind of a little bit, you know, reacting more than leading.
It's like a 1970s Best Actress role.
Okay, maybe, yes. Emma Stone's role is the definition of a Best Actress winning role. It's somebody who dominates the movie. The movie's about them. It's physical. It's like, you know, that. So all of these things that are kind of will be seen as brave or whatever. And that's on of itself is a narrative. But the one thing against her is that she already has an Oscar. So I don't think, and she's like, what, 32? So I don't think there is hurry in Hollywood to reward her again. But I think if she didn't have an Oscar, she would have definitely won for this. And there would have been no competition.
Well, speak for yourself, because that's not where... No offense to Emma Stone, that's not where my vote would have gone or would go.
Yeah, but that's not my vote either. My vote is Sandra Huller.
No, I know.
But
I mean,
I'm
mine
just,
too. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm saying that just, you know, the industry would have probably, you know, she's a big star, somebody who can put, totally. You know, so she would have won if she hadn't already had an Oscar for sure.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's really early still. But I think, yeah, I don't know. I think the thing, if we were to compare those two performances, the thing that I think tips it for Lily Gladstone for me is, again, just going back to those ideas. And like the ideas that Lily Gladstone's character is like, that Molly's dealing with, I feel like it's just more of like a psychological demand that I think is actually more difficult to put forward than what Emma Stone was doing. Like, I think Emma Stone's doing a lot, but I think it doesn't necessarily require it. This is always an Oscar battle. It's like subtlety or showy. And obviously the Oscars love showy and tend to go that route. But I think like there's such value in the very small, tiny details of what Lily Gladstone was doing that have to convey very, very big, complicated psychological states of being that like I think are very obviously put forward in Poor Things. And I find that less interesting personally.
Yeah, I hear you. I think it's a more obvious in your face performance. And it's definitely not subtle. It's the opposite of subtle. But I think she did an amazing job. I love her. I love Emma Stone. I'm coming out as an Emma Stone fan. If you didn't
I'm watching
know,
The Curse. She's killing it on The Curse.
Oh, she's so funny. I haven't seen The Curse yet. I'm saving that for like January when there's nothing to see.
Oh, that's a good one. I've been trying to work out again. And so that's my like 1 hour long show that I'll like put on while I'm doing something.
Well, you're doing. Oh, perfect. Okay, cool. That is perfect. So
just as the filmmakers intended, I'm sure.
Yes. So kind of that's our take on Poor Things. So go see it. Let us know what you thought of it. I'm sure we'll be talking about it more as it starts winning awards and getting nominations. The other movie that we want to talk about is one I think we're the opposite side of is Alexander Payne's The Holdovers, which I didn't like much, and I think you liked it.
I did.
So, Izzy, what's The Holdovers about?
The Holdovers is about a New England boys' school, like private sleepover, but I don't know, there's a campus of this school where the boys live, and there's a teacher played by Paul Giamatti who's kind of a grump and is notoriously difficult, and he's put in charge of watching over the boys who do not have anywhere to go for Thanksgiving for various reasons, and so there's a group of about five of them, but through a weird twist of fate it ends up being just one boy who basically just has to hang out with Paul Giamatti and their chef, the school's chef, and like random teachers and people they meet on the campus throughout the trip. But it basically becomes like the two of them hanging out and getting to know each other. And I don't know, like having revelations about their own lives through each other. It is done. And here's why I liked it. This film, if you watch it, it feels like it's not a period piece. It feels like it was actually made in 1970. And they do this very purposely, like everything about it, the music they use, the title sequences, even the trailer. If you've seen it, you'll know that it had voiceover, which is almost never used anymore. It's very much made intentionally to feel like you just stumbled upon TCM one day and there's this like a gem that they unearthed from an archive somewhere that Hal Ashby made. In that way, I think it can feel very predictable. It's not really trying to do anything new. But at the same time, I think it kind of hits a nostalgia for people who love that kind of movie and love those filmmakers, to kind of see a very well done homage to that kind of filmmaking and that kind of sense of humor. So that's kind of why I enjoyed it. I mean, I think it's a very heartwarming story and all of that, but I think just kind of the experiment of doing a period piece in that fashion was really successful and really fun to watch.
Yeah, I think the predictability that you mentioned was my problem with it. Like, I think my first reaction after I left, I was like, there were like 17 Chekhov guns that I clocked in the first half hour, and they all came off. And I'm just like, the first half hour, I knew exactly how this movie's gonna end. I knew exactly what's gonna happen. I knew exactly what I'm supposed to feel. I knew exactly what every character is gonna end up in the end with. And I was just like, why am I here? I already have seen this film. And that was my problem with it. And I didn't think it was heartwarming at all because it was just so obvious. I mean, it was trying to be heartwarming, but maybe I'm just a cold bitch because I
Aren't we
did.
all sometimes? Aren't we all
Because,
sometimes?
yeah, I did not feel anything. And I had a major problem with the character played by Divine Joy Randolph, who is, she is one of the three main characters. She is the is she the cook? The cook, right? She's the cook at the school who also has she's a holdover. She's staying too. And this is in 1970, so her son has just died in Vietnam. And I was just like, I can't believe we're still doing this. We're still doing the virtuous black person who is so hard up. They are the help and they have a tragedy, and we're supposed to feel sorry for them, but all their purpose is to be there so that the white people in the movie can learn a lesson or learn to be compassionate, or whatever. She's a magical Negro. And then they did try to do something with her. They gave her one scene where she becomes a mean drunk. So at least there's that. So I do acknowledge that. It's not a magical Negro from the beginning to end. She has a scene where she's a mean drunk. I think the performance is very good considering what she's been given to work with, but I rolled my eyes so many times. Not at the actor because she's wonderful, but at the writing that's very simplistic. And I'm like, yes, you're trying to make a movie from 1970, but we're in
But you don't have to
2023.
use the tropes from 1970. Yeah,
Exactly.
that's
We are
a
from,
totally fair point. I hear you. Yeah, for sure.
yeah, don't use those tropes. So that was like my big major point, was not liking this film. We're over, white liberals trying to tell us, oh, whatever, black people, yes, we should feel compassion to you. I'm like, fuck you. That's the bare minimum.
Yeah, where's the money?
Yeah.
That's
Or
usually
whatever. Like,
missing.
write her a complex character. Write her, she doesn't have to be angry. Like, there's not just two things. You are either an angry black man or a compassionate black woman. Like, come on. There's got to be more to the black experience in this country than that. Like, and all in the serve of what? So some white teenager and white middle-aged man can learn a lesson and be friends and be nice to the black lady? Like, what the fuck? Anyway.
No, I think you're totally right. And I think that is kind of where the film, I think, falls a little short, is how predictable it is. And maybe, like, I don't know, the lessons I should, I guess, be consistent. So, like, if the lessons that were in Poor Things weren't necessarily complex or mind-blowing, then I should be consistent and say, like, the same thing of the holdovers. Like, that is true. They're not exactly complex or surprising or unique revelations about the human experience in the holdovers either. But yeah, but I do think, like, I don't know, just something about the holiday vibes and New England schools. I am a tad biased toward those topics, I will admit, since that is, like, my experience. But
And we all have those biases, and that's great. You enjoyed, you just had a better time watching The Holdovers, and I had a better time watching Poor Things. And in the end, that's it. It's all subjective, and in the end, you can't separate your biases from what you see. So.
Well, I mean, hopefully you I think to a degree you should be able to, but it's also like,
I actually don't try to separate my biases, because I just think in the end, criticism and what we do is subjective, and it's my opinion. I'm not telling anyone, like, you know, this is the opinion, as some critics do, and those are the critics I don't like reading, who are like, just think it's my opinion and that's the right opinion. Those people are terrible. The way I write and the way I talk about movies is like, it's just my opinion. It's one of a million. So,
but that's what I like though too, because I think when the people who assume like my opinion is the right opinion are obnoxious to begin with, but then it's also kind of like, it doesn't leave room for just like, things can kind of meet a qualitative threshold, and then from there taste kind of takes over, and like what you kind of personally like and don't, and like you're never alone in your taste. Like, we obviously like a lot of the same things.
So
it's like,
sure,
when I read your reviews, I could be like, well, I know that I generally like trust and agree with him, so that helps me like inform how I might think about it. You know what I mean? Like, you subscribe to certain tastes, and that's really helpful with criticism, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with you. Yes. The other thing I wanted to talk about was the holdovers, and it's back to the Divine Joy Randolph part, is that if we're talking about awards, this is the performance that everybody thinks is at the top of the best actress list. And that
best
is
supporting
very,
actress.
Best, oh yeah. Not best actress, best supporting actress. Yeah. You're right. Best supporting. And I think it's because it's the white guilt thing. Most of the people voting or pundits or whatever just see this and be like, oh yes, she broke my heart. I have to vote for her. She's going to win. And she is good. You know, this is, I, for the 17th time, this is not against the actor. She is wonderful. But this is a terrible part. And I just think there is such richness in the women performing on the margins of amazing movies this year. And this performance is not up there.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it in my top five for sure.
Yeah.
And also, I think when, I feel like I've made videos before where I break down like the best supporting actress wins by Black characters, and they're almost always literally the help.
Yes. Exactly.
And so like, putting, I think, award, you shouldn't not award for that reason, just to like defy the trope, but also like, that is, that would be very concerning to keep adding to that
to the
list.
Trope. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like there's so many things that haven't even come out yet. Like, I'm hearing so much about Danielle Brooks from The Color Purple.
Yes.
Who I saw on stage, and like, I would believe that she absolutely is going to do something crazy.
Oh, for sure. I'm seeing The Color Purple tonight, so I will report back next week. Yes. So there is Danielle Brooks and Taraji P. Henson and Shug Avery, and those two parts were played and nominated the last time The Color Purple was made into a movie in the 80s. So that always happens, just like, you know, the West Side Story Anita part won the Oscar again. Those things.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Out. So
too bad Oprah didn't win the first time, though.
Yes. But I think Danielle Brooks, that part is very good, and she has a very good song. So I think, and she's such a charismatic actor.
She's like, so
she's
good.
So
I really love
fantastic.
Her.
One of the best contemporary actors working today on stage, on film, on TV, whatever medium. She is always so watchable and so amazing. And so I'm excited to see her, and I'm excited to see what she can do with Sophia, which is an amazing part. And I saw her on stage. I saw her on stage, and she was amazing, right? Like, she was so good.
Yeah, she was so good.
Yeah.
Who else were you thinking for best supporting actress?
So I love Claire Foy in All of Us Strangers, which is opening later this. I love the specificity of that performance, because the story that it's based from is a straight love story, but it's about a man connecting with his parents, and Andrew Hay made it about his parents. He even shot it in his you know, childhood home, and she plays the mom, and she plays a very specific woman born in the late 40s, early 50s. The story takes place in her part of the story takes place in 1987, and it's very specific to how English women of that era think about themselves and talk and deal with queer people and with their families, husbands and children. And it's the writing, but I just think it's such an amazing, specific film. And it's also the emotional wallop, because he's searching for acceptance from his parents, as, you know, a middle-aged queer man whose parents died when he was really young. And when she gives it to him, And I'm spoiling my review because I wrote it, but it hasn't been published yet. When she gives it to him in the movie, I think she absolves a whole generation of men who have wanted to hear that from their mothers, and a lot of them have not had. So it's very specific, and I think it hits a chord with, you know, queer men in particular, because that relationship between a queer man and his mom is very special, and it has like lots of you know, lots of complexity, for lack of a better word. And I think that's great, a great performance. And
Andrew Scott would be my best actor vote.
Oh my God, he's so wonderful.
Easily.
Yes. Easily. He's so wonderful. The other, you know, we both love May December, and we hear Julianne Moore is running supporting. So let's go.
That's so crazy that she's running supporting. I mean, I get it, but it's also like, in what world? But also, sure.
Yeah, like they're not going to put two actresses in Best Actress. That doesn't happen anymore. They have to divide and conquer.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
And, you know, we talked about May, December a little bit when we talked about New York Film Festival. The movie is now out in theaters and it's going to be on Netflix very soon. So maybe this is a chance to just talk a little bit about Julianne Moore's performance and why I think it's, you know, Julianne Moore is somebody who is such a hit and miss for me. Sometimes I'm just like, what are you doing? But sometimes she is so fucking amazing. I just want to jump out and scream about how amazing she is. And she is amazing in May, December. She plays the ultimate narcissist. And, you know, the choices she makes in this film, the lisp, the famous lisp. And now we can talk about it since the movie's out. Her character has this lisp. And I remember when a movie played at New York, I asked Todd, was that lisp in the screenplay? And he's like, no. Julianne showed up with the lisp the first day, and Natalie had to learn it because Natalie's playing the actress who they will then play her.
Yep.
And so not only is she amazing, but she gave Natalie Portman homework. So we love her double.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I think this is one of Julianne Moore's best performances in years. Like, I don't even know when the last one that's been this strong.
Probably still was. Alice, or maybe even before that.
I think this is still Alice.
Yes, it is better, but that was a good performance. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's because, oh, maybe the hours.
Oh, wow. You're going back to the early 2000s. Let's go.
Sorry, Julianne. It's the script, though, I would say.
Yeah.
But I would say that there's something really nice about seeing her in a position where she is kind of evil. I feel like she gets to play the good girl a lot. The good girl and the suffering wife and or mother. And here she's suffering, but it's kind of employed in a way that is so malicious and so viciously executed and like predatory.
Yes.
And it's so like, I don't know. It's just so stunning to see her in that kind of position because it's just so anti-Julianne Moore.
Yes. She's always so maternal.
I actually have not seen The Hunger Games, any of them, so I don't know if she's...
Oh, those movies
are
terrible.
She's a bad person, right? She's a bad person.
Yeah, she's never good at playing evil, especially in big blockbusters.
But she
like,
is
that's
here.
Her nadir. She is here because she's working with Todd Haynes, and because the script is so smart and because it gives her so many things to say and do, and because she's acting against Natalie Portman, who elevates her too. Let's not forget that the best scenes in this movie are the when her and Natalie are in the same frame.
Okay, do you remember that scene where Charles Melton's character, whose name I'm forgetting, confronts her in the bedroom and he's like, I thought, you know, like, why can't we talk about these things? It's in the trailer. And she basically breaks down, and this is the moment where you're like, this woman is fucked up. Like, this woman has so many issues. I can't even begin to describe where to start with them. But that scene was, I think it's so perfect that you said that she was maternal, because you can see the way that he is like using her maternal nature to emphasize how far apart in age these two people are.
Yeah.
And so it really is just like a son comforting a mother, as opposed to like a pair of equals in this relationship.
Yeah.
And it's really jarring and scary and perfect casting. And I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And what a fucked up woman.
I'm obsessed with her too. Like, this is the kind of performance that you just don't forget. You keep thinking about, and you keep reliving moments. And she's so funny, and she's, to your point, so scary. And how can you do that and still be so watchable? Like, when she's on, you don't want to look elsewhere, despite the amazing work that Natalie Portman is doing. Yes.
It's interesting. Like, sometimes when you watch actors, you're thinking, oh, there's nothing going on behind the eyes. And what you usually mean by that is that they're not putting enough energy into the performance, or they're being lazy, or they're not sure how to convey the emotion. But with Julianne Moore's performance in May, December, there's nothing going on behind the eyes because she chooses that.
Mm-hmm.
Because this woman is a sociopath and has no idea how to respond to everyday social interactions.
Yes, or anything or anyone. It's just like she's so manipulative. All what she knows how to do is manipulate the situation and the people around her. And it's so scary, but it's so fun to watch. It's like, I don't know. Like, this is, the more I speak to you about it, the more I think it's maybe her best performance ever. Like, she's,
it's up there
so,
for sure.
It's, she is it, people.
She's it. I was thinking about it, though, because speaking of the Gotham Awards, Charles Melton won yesterday, which is fantastic for May, December. But I was thinking about it, if the only performance Todd Haynes directs that wins an Oscar is a man's performance, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yeah, I will lose my mind, too, especially in this movie.
I think he was great. I love Charles Melton's performance. But I just think it's, like, ironic in the scheme of Todd Haynes' directorial career and how many truly incredible female performances he's directed that it would be just so funny if he, like, directs a man, like, once in a good role.
Yeah. I mean, the performance that should have won in a Todd Haynes movie for sure is Rooney Mara and Carol. Like
really, Kate was, not Kate.
Well, Kate was not going to win a third Oscar 2 years after winning her second, so that was not going to happen.
Okay, still, that's the one that wins.
Of course, I would have wanted them both to win, but I think there was a time when, like, especially considering who won, which was Alicia Vikander for The Danish Girl. Like, come on, people. But yes, I agree with you. I would be heartbroken if it's Charles Melton who wins Todd Haynes' first Oscar for acting. But also, I don't think he's going to get nominated because the Gothams are good at anointing people for bigger careers. But whoever they choose to win almost never wins the Oscar.
Troy Kotsur won.
Yeah,
so it's From Everything Everywhere All at Once. He won.
Yes, there is always one who wins, sure. But for the most part, they don't. Like, you know, the year of Kate in Blue Jasmine, they gave their award to Brie Larson. The year of Frances McDormand in Nomadland, they gave it to Nicole Beharie. Sometimes they're more about, oh, we believe in you. You have the talent to become somebody major. And I think this is what's going to happen to Charles Melton. I don't think he's going to win an Oscar. And I think his chances at a nomination are, you know, I wouldn't call them slim, but they're not huge.
Here's where I think it might be somewhat in his favor, though, is because with Nicole Beharie, for example, or your other example is Brie Larson.
Yeah.
Those are films where it's like there's literally no shot that this is nominated for an Oscar. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like this is the opportunity for, like, that film to get something out of the year.
Yeah.
Whereas May, December, I mean, Todd Haynes isn't, like, an Oscar favorite or anything, but
his actors get nominated.
Yeah. Like, there's enough crossover with that where it's kind of like, I could see it not being kind of like, oh, this is the May, December prize. Like, this is, you're just getting it, like, good for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, Todd was so happy for him when he won. So, you know,
yeah,
We want Todd to be happy, so this is the way to make him happy.
Anything for Todd.
Yeah. And, back to our sort of best supporting actress conversation, there is, of course, Jodie Foster, who we talked about in Naiad, who will see the bet. Is she going to get nominated or not? And there is, of course, Emily Blunt in Oppenheimer, who people think will get nominated. I love Emily Blunt, but she doesn't do much.
I still need to see that. Damn.
But the woman who does so much, and she's in one of the worst movies of the year, is Penelope Cruz in Ferrari. Ferrari is not about Penelope Cruz. Ferrari is about Ferrari. And I don't know why they cast Adam Driver when the story takes
place. Italians exist.
Not only Italians exist, but like 50-year-old men exist. In the story, he's around 55, 56. I'm like, why are you casting Adam Driver and then, giving him prosthetics to make him look saggy and gray hair? That's and so whatever. Funny. It's terrible choice, and then he has that accent. But it doesn't matter, because every time Penelope Cruz is on screen, that woman has charisma for 7,000 other people, and she charges through this movie as Ferrari's wife, and she just makes it her own with sheer will of force. Like, there is literally a scene of her walking away from him with her back to the camera, to Adam Driver, and the camera is on her. And I swear there was more feeling and more emotion in the way she's walking with her back, and you're only seeing her back, than there is in like millions of performances that people give awards to. So I don't know Penelope Cruz how she does it, especially when she plays Italians. She is just on fire. Her accent, of course, is perfect because I think she speaks Italian, and that's not it, but it's the emotion and the things that she does in this movie. She's so watchable. And if there was no Claire Foy and there was no Julianne Moore, she would be my I can't choose between those three. I just think they're all fantastic, and I still haven't seen The Color Purple. So there's just a lot of wonderful performances in Best Supporting Actress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Including our favorite movie of the year, Saltburn, which has Rosamund Pike.
Listen. I know I wouldn't, put her on like a nominations list, but I thoroughly enjoyed her performance in that.
Yeah, she's funny. I think what we can promise, maybe a gift to our listeners for Christmas, is maybe we'll do an episode where we talk about Maestro and Saltburn, and we're going to be salty about both.
I know. I keep seeing so many good reviews of Maestro coming out, and I'm just like, am I going crazy? It feels like, I don't know. I mean,
Maestro might win Best Actor and Best Actress. Oh,
I know. And I don't want to think about it. It probably will win Best Actor, which is annoying. But
I am not as annoyed as you are with Maestro, but I also don't think it deserves awards.
It's just so flagrant. Anyway, flagrant foul.
So,
you know what I thought was interesting, though, speaking of the Gothams and Best Supporting Actress, first of all, that Sandra Hüller, of the two performances she has this year, was nominated in supporting for Zone of Interest rather than lead in Anatomy of a Fall, because to me, of the two of them, Anatomy of a Fall is far superior.
I don't know,
in terms of a performance,
who was on that like performance jury. I'm like, what are you doing, girl?
And then but then also, I really hope she does not win Best Supporting Actress. I don't know that she would even get nominated for.
I don't think
Actress,
she's gonna get nominated. No,
I do not want. My nightmare would be like an oppressor Nazi woman.
Oh God, yeah, we don't want. I don't know. Yeah, I think Danielle Brooks or Divine Joy Randolph or even Julianne Moore like will have better chances than her. They're just flashier, bigger parts. Yeah.
Yeah.
For winning anyway. I mean, people love her so much this year, and she's rising this wave of like the best actress of the year, then she might get two nominations, but I don't think she'll win. And Anatomy of a Fall did very well at the Gothams. It won Best International and Best Screenplay. Mm-hmm. So that bodes well for her for the film itself. I think the film is going to be loved, and I wouldn't be surprised if she wins, like if she becomes a Cate Blanchett and Tara of this year and wins a lot of the critics' awards.
Sure. And then kind of doesn't make it across the finish line.
Yeah. Doesn't win the Oscar, but definitely
Sad.
Gets nominated. Yes.
I always pick some like middle-aged German to like be infatuated with for award yes. season.
This is the Sandra Hüller fan podcast. But we promise you we will talk about Maestro and Saltburn before the year is over. And let us know if there are other December movies. We'll probably talk about All of Us Strangers, The Color Purple, which is coming at Christmas. We'll probably talk about in January. But we have other surprises coming in December. So stick around, tell your friends, tell your neighbors that this is the best podcast and give us some 5 stars. Izzy, where can the lovely listeners find you?
Twitter is BK Rewind, Instagram BK underscore Rewind, YouTube Be Kind Rewind.
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Emmy underscore says, on Instagram at Mortada underscore E, and you may read my reviews at Variety and the AV Club. This week, I'll have reviews for American Fiction and Eileen, which are the two movies that are also released the same day as Poor Things, and we will probably discuss later on the podcast.
Fabulous.
All right. I think we're good.
Beautiful.